What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Aaron Sagers, and this is Talking Strange.
Aloha, spooky nerds, and welcome to Talking Strange, the paranormal pop culture show with the Den of Geek Network. I'm your host, Aaron Sagers, also appearing as host on the Netflix series 28 Days Haunted and on the Travel Channel and Discovery Plus show, Paranormal Caught on Camera. This week, I wanted to kick off the new year, 2023, with an interview I conducted last year at Dragon Con in Atlanta in September 2022. I was fortunate to be booked as a featured guest at that con, and I had a panel with two podcasters I immensely respect. Now, this is a bit of a lost episode because, as I said, we recorded it live at Dragon Con, and we had the intent to publish it back then, but the audio feed went missing. It was quite mysterious. However, I recently acquired some third-party audio of the panel. I say acquired, like it came into my possession, like it's illicit goods. Now, I do think it's a good talk, but the audio itself is a bit dodgy. So I did want to make use of it. I didn't want this to go to waste because my guests are Holly Fry and Payne Lindsay. Now, Holly Fry, she has been the host of the award-winning podcast Stuff You Missed in History Class for 10 years, and she created and hosts the historical true crime podcast Criminalia, which is a joint production of iHeartRadio and Shondaland Audio. She has executive produced numerous other shows for iHeartRadio Podcast Network, including Dressed, The History of Fashion. And when she's not talking about the past, she's sewing, she's obsessing over Star Wars, she's visiting a Disney park, and she's traipsing around town in ridiculous costumes or obsessing over delicious food. Sometimes she does several of these things at once. She's one of my favorite people out there. I love her to death. I'm so happy that she could join me. And we also have Payne Lindsay. He's a director and award-winning documentary filmmaker. The Atlanta area native founded Tenderfoot TV in 2016, co-creating and hosting the company's flagship show, Up and Vanished. And that spawned Tenderfoot's first television series by the same name. Payne would also host the critically acclaimed Atlanta Monster and the anthology series Radio Rental, which is also hosted by Terry Carnation, a.k.a. Rainn Wilson from The Office. And Terry Carnation and Payne have previously been on Talking Strange. Now, we pick up the audio in a bit of an abrupt area because I was asking a question about how Payne and Holly entered into this world of weird history and true crime, and we dive right into it. So I apologize for the quirky transition. Please bear with us, but I do think overall you're going to enjoy this chat.
So if you had told me 15 years ago that I would host a history podcast, I would have laughed in your face. Because I thought I hated history growing up, like so many of us do, because I think so many of us end up in those like classes where you memorize dates and names, and it doesn't feel like it's germane in any way to what you're doing in your day-to-day life. And that sucks, and it's a bad way to learn history. And that's not shade to teachers, because often they have to prepare you for a test, and that's what it's about. But, like, I didn't realize until I had worked in a library for almost 11 years, and I worked in acquisitions, and I had that deal where, like, at the end of the day when our curriculum materials were done, because I worked for a university library, I had fairly free rein to buy what I wanted with our remaining budget. And our head librarian one day was like, this hilarious man who was like 8 million wonderful years old, he was like, you love history. And I was like, F you. No, I do not. And he was like, Holly, all of the stuff that you're buying with discretionary budgets are things like embroidery in 16th century China and about Victorian bustling and stuff. And he was like, you just don't know it because you think of it as fashion. And I was like, that's literally what it was like. Oh my God, I love history. Like, I really, it was a very strange revelation for me. And then in terms of podcasting, feel bad when people ask me how I got into podcasting because I didn't have a choice. I was working as a copy editor and a site editor for How Stuff Works. And our boss one day at a party that was after work heard Tracy and I being very, very snarky. And we got called into his office the next morning and I thought I was getting fired. And in fact, he said, "Oh, I think you're funny together. You should have a podcast." And that is how that happened. Because I never would have sought that out, I don't think, for myself. And then here we are 12 years later. That podcast was actually a show called Pop Stuff, which was about sociology and pop culture. And at the time, Stuff You Missed in History Class had already existed in several iterations. It had changed hosts many times while it kind of tried to find its voice. And then as one of our previous hosts took a job elsewhere, she had a great opportunity presented to her. The other person who co-hosted with her said, like, "This is kind of a bear to do every week.
Right.
I think I would like a break." And so we just moved on to that show. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
All right. Love it. And Payne, like, obviously, you know, I think people associate you, your work with a lot of true crime stuff, but it is also history. You're telling current history and you're looking back to the past. Was this something that you were always interested in, or was it something that developed out of just current events?
I mean, I think in its simplest form, I've always been into the things that you can't explain, just weird unsolved mysteries, like quite literally the show Unsolved Mysteries. I've been binging that again for the second time on Apple TV, and just always like just the idea that there's, you know, something else out there that we don't understand. And so at one point 6 years ago, I just had this crazy idea as a broke freelance filmmaker to make a true crime podcast about a missing person and go try to solve the mystery. And that turned into Up and Vanish, which is a podcast. And then from there, I've kind of expanded on the different kinds of stories that I get into. Not really a history buff, but I think history is clearly important and it's relevant to our future. But damn, do they make it boring as hell in school books. It's just, and I didn't buy it for 1 second that you didn't like history before. Like,
I really didn't. I mean, I thought exactly what you thought. It was dull, but it's like when you start looking at the nuances of history stories. Like, my big soapbox thing is that what we are taught about history is that it is what happens on thrones and in seats of government. But really, like, we are all making history every single day. And those are the stories that really make history alive, is when you see somebody like yourself from, you know, 17th century Italy, and you're like, oh my gosh, there was this weird person who couldn't figure out what they wanted to do with their life, and then they ended up in a job they didn't expect, and then, oh, that's like me, I get this. There were people always like that, and then history starts to become a lot more real, and you see how there have always been women, you might not know that if you're religious, there have always been people of color, there have always been people all over the LGBTQIA spectrum, but they're not the ones that got to tell the stories. Like, isn't it interesting that the people who wrote the history books are always the good guys? That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's because they're writing it.
Right.
They're never going to be like, "I was the jerk, and yet I won."
The best is when you find that weird doppelganger of yourself. I mean, I haven't yet, but I've seen other people do it. Just some rando from 1733 who looks just like you. Like, we still make the same kinds of looking people.
Yeah.
Somehow, like, oh shit. The algorithm hit that one right.
It's basically a limited number of templates. Like, you know, there's,
right.
there's a lot Fine like humans, but there is basically a repeatable pattern, and every so often it is replicated. So there's another Payne, another Holly, maybe, God help me, another Aaron out there. The idea of true crime and history within the podcast realm, like, is certainly we could say become popular. Has that made your jobs more difficult when there's not only a lot of other podcasts and a lot of other independent films taking place out there in the true crime and history realm? Has it made it more difficult to conduct your business because there is so much else out there?
I would say that, I mean, just from the business standpoint, sure, there's more content, that's similar because we figured out that people like this kind of stuff. But for me, when I first made my first true crime podcast, I never actually felt like I was making a true crime show. I wasn't the kind of true crime buff that you could potentially think that I was. Mm-hmm. I was just into the suspense element of it all and chose to put myself into the story and be that person to try to figure this shit out. And that became something after that. So yeah. I think that for me, I get bored with this stuff very easily. And so I'm looking at it like, yeah, there's tons of these things, but what's the next thing that I can do that feels like I'm branching off this way and, I don't know, taking another risk and not feeling like I'm just now in the spin cycle of what we think this kind of content should be or feel or sound like. But that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, when we started brainstorming Criminalia, one of the things that I'm very aware of, and I bet you are too, is that there is this tendency with a lot of true crime to start to feel a little bit weird and voyeuristic. And sometimes that just doesn't feel very enjoyable for me as a listener. I feel strange about it. And what I like about doing stuff that's a little further back in history is twofold. One, you can kind of sidestep that. No one is going to listen to us talk about, you know, Rachel Wall, who was the last woman to be hanged in Massachusetts, and go try to find her mom and ask her questions. Like, mm-hmm. that's just not going to happen. It's too long ago, and so we've sidestepped that problem. But the other thing is that it kind of goes back to my earlier point about how magically the people who wrote history books were all the good guys. There are a lot of people that were criminalized throughout history that when you look at their business now, it is a very different vibe. The person who actually inspired that entire show was a woman named Julia Tofana, and she is one of several poisoners in Europe in, you know, a stressful...
Is that a job, a poisoner?
Yes! How do you think Nero got the throne? So there were a lot of poisoners in Europe at the time, but there were some women poisoners in particular who had taken it upon themselves to help women out of abusive marriages by saying, I can get you out of this. Because divorce was not an option. A woman had no power to say, like, oh, I'm gonna leave. But those women are talked about like they were these murderesses, and it's like, yeah, but they were fighting for the underdog, right? Like, they're trying to help somebody who has no other recourse. And so that, yeah. to me, becomes a little bit more interesting about historical true crime, is that you can be like, there's a lot more nuance than we ever actually got about these people. So that's what is kind of fun.
There's more information out there, obviously, more than ever, which is both a good thing, but also can it be a challenge when not only are you trying to find the stories, but trying to research them, because there's bad information out there as
well. Yeah.
So the fact that there's more people talking about history, and I think this is kind of what I'm getting to, is like the more the people are talking about it, the more information is out there, and the more bad information is out there.
Have I ever told you that we sometimes do episodes just to make sure the correct information is done after we hear one of those episodes that someone else has done?
No, you didn't tell me that.
I do. So this isn't in the true crime space, but there was it's the best example I can give. There was a surgeon in the 19th century named Robert Liston, and he became famous for amputations. He did really fast amputations. He kind of got this reputation as a showboater. And there's a famous story that in one amputation, he killed three people. The patient, one of his attendants, and a man who was watching it because he was so horrified he died of a heart attack. That is a story that gets repeated over and over and over. There is absolutely no historical basis for it. And Robert Liston did do demonstrations, and he showed people, I can amputate a leg in under 30 seconds. But his point was not, I'm so fast, I'm a butcher. It was, hey, we don't have anesthesia yet. We have to be faster and better than we've ever been because we're torturing these people as we're trying to get rid of diseased limbs. And that's a very different story than what you have heard over and over and over about that man. So that is like a case where I was like, let me read from the book of Robert Liston. because you want to correct those and make sure people understand the context of some of those stories and how they come about.
I like that you're leading the charge on rehabilitating Robert Liston's reputation.
He was actually pretty great.
But you want that to be true, kind of. You're like, I hope there was a guy once. I mean, I'm sorry for people who died, but that sucks. If they did die, if that is true.
Well, that's the thing. There's no evidence that surgery ever took place. That's like the kind of thing that got probably a tall tale told by someone who had witnessed a surgery at some point and saw a guy pass out and was like, I heard everybody died.
It's not even an art form. I mean, I think any of us could saw a leg off real quick if that was, you know, $1 billion.
And have the
saw
patient
leg off 20
live.
Seconds. You can't get that thing
with
off.
With minimized pain.
And now we have the
you
challenge
have a very
portion of our
podcast.
I mean, give me the tools first. I don't know how. I mean, just saying. I mean, if it's a race, then let's go.
I feel like this could be an entire panel at DragonCon of how fast can you amputate someone's limb.
It's gonna be.
I would show up to that. The.
No, thank you.
The, I find, and Payne, I kind of want you to answer this because the more we study history, but also the more we learn about people, it's very easy to get cynical about humans. I'm kind of the school of thought that no one should have a statue erected in their honor because when you treat someone as a hero, you inevitably will learn that, well, they weren't that heroic or they were a flawed individual. Through your work, have you developed a cynicism about humans?
So here's where I'm currently at, and you know it'll probably evolve throughout the rest of my life. I feel like people are innately selfish. And I mean that in a sense, just a general sense. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, regardless of what you believe in, just from evolution, you know, evolving and banging rocks around and having to scavenge for food, you know, you care about your meal first. It's just a big, so I feel like just throughout time, now there's some special people out there who are really just completely caring of other people in a way that that's just impressive to me, right? Where they're just not selfish. But I think innately, almost in our DNA, I feel like, that people are selfish even just out of necessity, and it just hasn't really gone away entirely. And so that can make shitty people sometimes. Mm-hmm. But there are people who stand out above that who are either smarter, more caring, loving, and those are the people I feel like you should stay close to because they're evolving in the right direction and they aren't just trapped in whatever, however we were built. I think, yeah, that makes any fucking sense.
Well, no, it makes sense. I mean, even when you, every time you fly, the instructions, the safety instructions are, if the mask drops down, you put your mask on first before you help anyone else, which is very practical. But it is also cover your own ass.
But the reality is, if the mask drop, you're fucked, right? Like I've been on a lot of flights. The masks have not dropped yet. I feel like if the masks are dropping, the plane's crashing. You're not gonna. The mask is just to make it feel better.
Yeah.
What's going on?
About yeah.
Yeah. It's a distraction before you hit the water.
But take care of your own distraction before you help someone else.
Yeah, exactly. It takes more time that way.
Yeah. What's your take? Like, have there been people that have emerged, well, you mentioned listening, but are there people that have emerged as villains that you previously thought of as heroes? And you now, do you have a cynicism about?
Yes and no. Okay, one, I will say, like, I have always kind of been guided, this is so nerdy, I'm sorry, by Blakean philosophy in this regard. So William Blake wrote that, like, you couldn't really be good unless you understood the darkness, unless you understood your own proclivity for evil. Like, you're making the choice to be good. That's what gives it value. And so I've never presumed anybody to be purely good. You can't. There's too much nuance. And, like, we have a joke on our show that, like, it doesn't matter what cute thing you think you're researching, you're going to find secret racism. It's just going to happen. I once wanted to do an episode on the Varro brothers, who were naturalists. They're the ones that discovered the lemur relative called the Varro subbaca, which is an adorable little animal with this ring tail. And while I was doing research,
totally non-problematic so far. Sounds great.
Oh, give me a sec. So, it's about to get so grimy because while they were traveling through Africa looking for new species, they had made friends with this tribe in, we think, Botswana. We do not know for sure. They witnessed one of their funeral rituals, and then they went back later, they dug up the body, they taxidermied him, and they trotted that around Europe for years.
Like
that body was only repatriated to Botswana in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so this was an actual
human person that they then were like, look at the savages of the Dark Continent, and it's disgusting. And it's like, these are men who we have lauded for years as advancing science, as advancing our understanding of the world, but they were doing some really grisly, gross stuff because they didn't value other humans that were other than white Europeans. Yuck. And so finally, I mean, that has been a big issue that was finally repatriated. On the upside, there are people who do a lot of evil but have these beautiful moments of grace. Like, I'm in the middle of researching an episode about a man named Charles Chapin. He was one of the biggest and most powerful publishers, not Charles V. Chapin, if you're thinking about the scientist. He was an editor in New York. He was, like, known to be astonishing in the 19-teens. Like, everybody wanted to work for him. He was Hearst's nightmare because he worked for Pulitzer. Reached a point where he had an experienced debt. He was having a nervous breakdown. He planned to kill his wife and then himself. He killed his wife. He went into a fugue state. He did not kill himself. He came to in Washington Square Park and he immediately turned himself into the police. And he went to prison for all of this. But what's really interesting is that while he was at Sing Sing, he turned that big empty yard that they had, just about 2 football fields worth of area, into the most beautiful rose garden you could ever imagine. And one of the things that he really focused on was, I want the last steps into the death house to be the most beautiful place on the premises. Because I want men, no matter how bad they were, who are going to their last breath to see something beautiful before they die. And to that's me, it's so like, sweet. That's an astonishing and beautiful thing, that this man who knows he did very wrong things, and even recognized that he had been kind of a dick as a boss to a lot of people, like in his later years was like, what can I do to make somebody's life better because I have screwed up a lot of stuff? And, like, that's beautiful.
I mean, flowers can fix a lot of problems. That's just, right?
Well, his gardens became so renowned that, like, women's garden groups wanted to go to Sing Sing prison to do tours. Because you're like, how do you get your tulips?
They started poisoning other people.
How did you get these roses to look like that?
Is it eggshells? What's your secret?
Just, I need to take this to the grave, I promise. But, you know, what is the secret?
That's amazing.
That is a great story. Have you entered into any situations where you view someone as a villain and they come about as more rounded human, where you like them a little bit more?
I mean, I feel like just generally speaking, the more you dig back into time, you do find out, oh yeah, everyone was pretty shitty. I mean, especially in today's age, no one would fly today at all. Even people that are heroes, somehow they were all racist. It doesn't make sense. I didn't read that in the history books, but then you find out, oh damn, even that guy was racist. Okay. Like, wow, this is crazy. That to me is almost just like a running joke now, where I'm like, oh yeah, anything like pre, I don't know, 2005 is the danger zone.
How do you deal with that when you have, because your projects involve so many interviews with other people and let's say with Radio Rental, which we discussed recently, great show, and you have people submitting their stories. Do you have to vet them at all to make certain that they're also not, you know, a proud boy or whatever?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if it was a proud boy, I'd probably recognize that in some way, like, something's weird about all of this. I do think also there's a level for some people that, I mean, if you're from some small town and you only know what's in this little bubble, you might say some things in a way that I'm like, I'm going to do you a favor and not put that in here.
Right.
Because, and we talk together, and I know that you're not literally racist or whatever it is, sex, whatever it is, right? I'm like, I'm going to do you a solid by like
filtering
that
out.
Not how you say this anymore, right? So there's a little bit of that, but if they're like a piece of shit, then we're just not doing it. But I think that when we get to the point where we're actually interviewing, we've already gone through that process.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes someone will say something where I'm like, we don't say that anymore. And I think that it's just like, you know, just the same way your grandpa would say something fucked up. Or my, whatever, my grandpa, And you're like, oh, no, he means well. But you're like, okay, let's just not dig into that too much. But they saw me make a weird face. So, yeah. Try to do my part.
Yeah. Let's shift into the paranormal a little bit. And Holly, I'm going to start with you because you're not really a paranormal believer.
No.
Like, what's your metric of where are you at? Totally non-believer, cynic.
Oh God, I would love for somebody to prove something to me.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, everybody has had their weird moment, and I certainly have as well. But I just presume like there was a gas leak in my house. But yeah, I mean that's kind
which
of
which does happen,
right? It can happen. I mean.
So how do you approach? Because certainly, stuff you missed in history class, you do dip into these topics,
oh, yeah.
And it's kind of impossible to talk about some of these characters within a certain era without discussing their sort of paranormalist beliefs or their sometimes religious beliefs. So how do you dip into it even if you are not a believer?
Oh, I mean, listen, everybody's got their own point of view. And whenever we're talking about any of these stories, if someone believes in their soul, right? Mary Todd Lincoln is a great example. Mm-hmm. That woman believed. She needed to believe because that was how she was hanging on to reality. I'm not going to judge her. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't live her life. I don't. All I can do is, like, do as solid an effort of research as I possibly can and find out everything about her and tell her story and say, like, yes, she believed in it. I mean, there are a lot of people that we uncover when we're talking about these that are clearly people that are manipulating things for their own benefit, right? But. And in that case, we'll say, like, we pretty clearly see, like, William Mumler was very obviously faking spirit photography to get people who had lost people in the Civil War to pay him $25 to take a ghost picture, right? Like, that was, he never confessed to that, but it's pretty obvious. Even P.T. Barnum went on the stand and was like, I know bullshit, and this guy's covered in it. Mm-hmm. So, like, there are people who obviously do that, but I try to never bring my judgment into it, right? All we can do is really do the research and reveal what we've seen on it. And even if we say, listen, this isn't what I believe, but there were a lot of people that believed, for example, like Helena Blavatsky was the real deal, even though there were people that felt that they had disproven her completely in her mysticism. But there were lots of people that also did, and that's the only way we can really do it, is just report it as straight as possible.
Well, we discussed, Payne, recently, sort of where you're at with this world. You would not consider yourself, or would you consider yourself sort of in the camp of, oh, maybe this shit's real.
I think there's, I mean, most certainly things that do happen, not a lot, but sometimes that can't be explained by what we know right now today. Now, there are the gas leaks, and I had a weird vision, and this and that, or it looks weird on the phone, all kind of stuff, right? But I think that if you whittle it all down, and you get to this weird 1%, whatever it is, there are some things that happen that can't be explained. I think that eventually science will explain all of these things, from UFOs to even, you know, my views of ghosts and stuff have even changed too. I mean, I've heard enough stories from people, and just making my own assumptions here, but I feel like a ghost is not someone's spirit or soul, like some, you know, religious type of thing. It's more of a like time plane thing. You're stuck somewhere in some way that can be explained scientifically at some point. And like, I think if we could figure that out, then that's how you'd figure out even how UFOs even move around. Probably tapping into something that we don't really understand yet, that science has not been able to disprove is possible. We still don't know how to do it yet. I mean, even Einstein was on that tip with time being its own plane. So I think that all we know is that we don't know anything. And there's a lot of fun and hype around the paranormal, you know, UFO space and all that kind of stuff, because it's stuff that we don't know and you can't explain it very easily. But I think that science will eventually explain everything. It's not some, you know, mystical, magical thing going on. It's something that can actually make logical sense. We're just not there yet. We're not that evolved yet.
See, I agree. Which is why it fascinates me in so many ways that when you ask people, what is a ghost, their answer is already telling you a lot about the person. It's loaded with their own preconceived notions and their belief system and all of that.
Sure.
I think that what's cool is the fact that this weird stuff is happening and we don't have an explanation for it yet.
That's why we talk about it at all. It's because we don't know. We can all sit here and speculate and say, oh, it's not true, or they're making that up. And sometimes they are making it up, but you know, I almost think that the stigma behind the whole thing is what's gotten in the way of us actually figuring out some of the things that are really definitively fucking weird.
Sure, like, it's hard to justify getting an academic grant to explore, you know, paranormal phenomena, because then you're going to be laughed out of the university as a crackpot.
I think it's changing, though. I feel like just even the next generation of people, even just now, I mean, really respectable people look into that stuff, and they're not as afraid as they were 10, 20 years ago to go spend money and dedicate their lives into figuring this out, because eventually that's the only way we figure it out. Someone's going to be the person to do that, and then we all eventually, you know, 100 years from now, just accept that as fact because someone else went out and proved that for us.
And I want to hear from you guys if you have questions, but Holly, I will ask you, and Payne, I want your response too, because you have dipped into these stories that contain paranormal elements as well as the true crime and the history. What's been a story that you have found perhaps some of the more compelling that involve the unexplained? Has there been any story that you're like, okay, that's weird enough that it makes me a little bit more intrigued?
Ooh, I'm trying to think. Because usually, I mean, you just kind of... One, part of the thing is that I will eventually just categorize things as history mystery,
right?
Because we can't ever know, which is part of the problem.
That's kind of it, right?
Even if it was a thing that was well-documented at the time, journalistic standards were very, very different 100 years ago than they are today, and people could just kind of, like, put their opinion in a story as though it were fact, without any questioning. Granted, there are still problems in that realm going on, but like that was the standard. If you read like the New York Times from 1898, they will literally make statements like, that defendant's ugly, they must be guilty. And it's like, what? And the same thing applies to paranormal things. It couldn't be anything except for a ghost moving these items. So I'm trying to think of anything that's really made me go, that one for sure. And I can't come up with anything.
All right, we'll come back to you, Payne. I mean, because you're getting constantly a flood of stories.
I have a lot, but I'm not trying to like summarize this in the best way possible. This one continues to fuck with me, but I think it also kind of goes into maybe some potential scientific explanation for all this stuff eventually, right? So this couple, guy and girl, they're probably in their mid late 20s. They were boyfriend girlfriend. They lived in New York City. They came home from this club late at night. Went back to the apartment, went to sleep. Dude wakes up, and his girlfriend's there asleep. He was a cigarette smoker, so he went downstairs to smoke a cigarette, and he was sitting there smoking, and then all of a sudden, this cab pulls up, and it's his girlfriend. And he's like, what? I swear I just saw you. And she's yelling at him, she's freaking the fuck out, and she's marching upstairs, and yelling at him, not saying what's going on. They get into the apartment. She's literally fucking throwing stuff around, broke a coffee pot, broke the TV, throwing stuff around. Also, not to mention, she used her key to get in the apartment. And eventually, she storms downstairs. He's running like, what's going on? Like, what did I do? And she just drives off. And he's like completely heartbroken. And then a few seconds later, felt a hand on the back of his shoulder, and it was his girlfriend. And she was there like, hey, what are you doing down here? And he's like, what? Okay, what the fuck? And they go upstairs, the whole shit is completely in disarray, and everything's fucking broken, just how he thought it was. So she's thinking there's been a break-in.
Right.
And her dad was a cop, and they called, you know, the dad, and he's like having a hard time trying to explain what he felt happened here. And they go all the way to the point where they get the tape of, like the security tape of the actual apartment complex. And they see a girl who looks just like her going in with him and running up the stairs and going all, I mean, there's nothing inside the apartment, but all the way up until inside of the apartment. And then she's thinking that he's cheating on her, and the dad thinks it's some big weird thing. But eventually they got to the point, just as a couple, that like they were both telling the truth, and we just cannot figure this out. Eventually they broke up, but he has, if it was some mental weird thing that happened, right, then it's totally possible, right?
Right.
But it's the only time it's ever happened in his whole life. And so to me, that's like, it's interesting. It kind of, like, if you wanted to get all heady about it and all weird, you could say, oh, maybe there's like, you know, some timeline slip or something, right? Like some other version of these events, this happened, or, and maybe that sounds crazy because we just don't know, but maybe it's really just not that crazy. Somewhere out there is some other thing just living on top of each other, and that's how you even explain a ghost. It's like, oh yeah, they're just stuck in some weird thing, and they're not really a full being anymore. I don't know.
No, I mean,
in TED Talk.
No, I enjoy that just because I don't go anywhere with the assumption that something is haunted or not haunted, mm-hmm. and I don't say ghosts are this or that. Instead, I think it's not A, B, and C, it's all of the above. There's so much weirdness that's potentially out there. And I even wondered, like, these people that were locked away in asylums in the past because they were supposedly talking to someone that was not there, and now we're in 2021, and I go to events where people are poking around in those asylums with flashlights and asking questions of the ghosts. It's like, what if there's some weird situation where they are living in their timeline and we're living in our timeline, and they are encountering not ghosts, but us in the future? Even.
Sure. I mean, the big problem to me is that mental illness is totally in the way of us figuring that out. Because, I mean, if you have schizophrenia or something, these things are going to be real as hell to you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's and like that could be a rational way to explain it based on what we know now, but you can't always go to just that. No one has a momentary lapse of schizophrenia and doesn't have it anymore.
Yeah.
But so it's like, it's blurred the lines of how we can really kind of further push the ball to figure out what the hell's going on over here.
Well, I think. And Holly, I mean, if you don't have that story that you found the most compelling, I'm curious about your thought about just becoming a student of human nature through your history studies, historical studies. Kind of what do you think is happening when we have these peaks and valleys of paranormal enthusiasm?
Well, I think if you look at any, you know, kind of culture or moment in time where something like that really explodes, you can see the things that led up to it, right? Like, this is going to sound like a really weird place to start. But if you look at my man, Louis XIV, I love me some Louis XIV, right? Like, he had this plan when he was king of France, that he recognized globalization was happening, and he was like, how do we make the French identity something special and unique and maintain our place? He is the reason that we still think of France today as like the apex of design and art. He was literally like, okay, great, we're gonna invest in these things, we're gonna create schools for these things, we're gonna be all about
it. It does look cool still.
Right, but the thing was, he was also very good at statecraft. So while he was kind of building this image, he was also expanding France's geographical footprint. He was winning battles, he was doing some smart things. So his grandson, Louis XV, was not so good at statecraft. He wasn't terrible, he got along good with people. He didn't quite have the same level of vision, and he really enjoyed living a very big life. By the time we get to Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, they don't know how to do any of the statecraft. They only know how to do the party part. Here is the moment in time where the tarot deck happens, right? Like, tarot decks existed before this, particularly in 16th century Italy. They were huge. It was a game. There is still a game of tarot in France that's played with a deck that is just a game. It has nothing to do with mystical.
Wow.
And the thing was, it wasn't until 1781, so we're looking at 7 years into Louis XVI's reign, the country is in deep debt, they are messed up, it is on the eve of the French Revolution, everybody is ill at ease, and this one guy, Antoine Coeur de Jobelin, writes this book that is supposed to be a treatise about, like, the world and how the ancient world affects their modern world. And he is the first one that makes this strange assertion that the tarot deck is really the Book of Thoth, which which has been encoded in game form and sent via travelers to Europe because people in Egypt were so afraid of losing that mystical knowledge. And he's the first one that makes this assertion, but he dies right after that. And then Jean-Baptiste, I'm gonna blank out on his last name.
You could just say something.
Anyway, it's Atelier, yes. He decides, oh, people think this is an interesting idea. And he's the one who's literally like, by the way, the Pope card is no longer a trump card in a game that has mystical meaning, and we're going to rewrite it. And he was the first person that was like, and I'll read your cards for a fee. And people in France were so confused and scared at this point, because for 100 years they had been told by the Regency, like, we have a plan. We are doing the shit. We got you covered. And then it was becoming apparent they didn't. And so they just wanted something that made them feel like they understood the world, even though they didn't, to be able to go like, yes, but a man read my cards and he said I'm going to be financially safe. And that felt really good at a time when no one felt financially safe in France. And so those are the kinds of moments where that stuff explodes. I mentioned Mumler earlier. Spirit photography exploded in the period right after the Civil War because so many people had died and mothers and families and wives were just aching to see the people they loved again. And those are like the things, they're like those moments in cultural time. We're about to hit like a huge one, I feel like, because everybody feels a little prickly and on edge all the time. And we need something.
Really?
No. I'm very chill. But I think, you know, that's kind of what does it. You just want something that feels like it's soothing. You don't have to fully understand it because you're told it's not fully understandable, but that it's okay and that you can apply it to the world that already feels a mess. And you feel like you have a deeper understanding.
And I've talked about this before, and I agree. I mean, certainly the interest in the paranormal does tend to peak after major traumatic events. And yeah, after Civil War, it seemed like it reemerged after World War I. I think it emerged after 9/11, and it presented itself in the form of paranormal reality TV shows and the interest there. And it's going to be curious seeing what happens this next wave with COVID, but also the way that we have not fully processed the pandemic. People have died, a lot of people have died, but we haven't had this end to it. It's not like an end date. Like, the war is over. We're done. Go home.
Yeah. So, well, and even when wars end, they don't end. Right.
Right.
There were Civil War battles after.
Yeah, it's just a new thing we were going to have to adapt to.
Yeah.
And the bigger spectrum of 100 years, it looks like a little blip.
And by the way, most of us are not going to know what that is, ever.
Right.
Because we'll never have the perspective to recognize.
Right. I'm living like at least 100 more years, for sure.
I mean, I hope I do too, but I bet we still won't quite know.
And we'll still know nothing. Yeah, exactly.
Does anybody have any questions out there? I know at one point you had one. Yes, hi.
Person that you said claimed that tarot cards originated in Egypt?
It wasn't that the cards, well, they sort of originated in Egypt, but his name was Antoine Coeur, C-O-U-R-T,
okay,
de Gebelin, G-E-B-E-L-I-N.
Did you get that?
Yeah.
Looks like it sounds.
No, it's good.
Just like it sounds.
C-O-U-R-T?
Yeah, like court, okay. De Gebelin. There you go.
And how do you spell that? De Gebelin?
just use your, yeah. Got it.
D space and then G-E-B-E-L-I-N.
Thank you.
Yeah, he wrote a whole bunch of books in the 1780s about grammar and philosophy.
Really?
And tarot.
Interesting.
Like, to Castilian, it was all making sense of their contemporary world. It was basically like an encyclopedia. It would literally be like if someone wrote in an encyclopedia today, oh, by the way, did you know that silver goblets carry ghosts? And you'd be like, whoa! And then somebody takes it and runs with it. It was kind of like that.
You can find a publisher for that.
Sure.
I think there's some book proposals that would, or publishers that would pick that up. The, any other questions out there? The, yes?
I guess speaking for both of you, what, as you're looking, and especially Holly, as you're going into the Wayback Machine, what sort of patterns do you see? I mean, we're talking about the reemergence of paranormal after, you know, big, you know, global trauma or, you know, a societal trauma. Do you see other kind of waves of, like, these kinds of crimes?
result. None of those things ever were universally accepted. So it's almost like everything's always working in eddies, right? At the same time that people were suddenly like, oh, tarot cards are mystical. There are people who were like, no, baby, my Aunt Gertrude plays with that. It's nothing. She's literally just like at the kitchen table.
Aunt Gertrude?
Yeah, except she would have been French, so she would have been, you know, Aunt Jeannie or something. And similarly, you know, when the spirit photography was very popular, there were people constantly trying to prove that those people were completely making it up. In terms of patterns, I mean, I think it's more a matter of all of these elements are constantly always at play in any society for the most part, and they kind of just bubble up and have like their flashbulb moments, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are always arsonists, but sometimes there are arsons clustered together, and there are always people who are murderers, but sometimes there will be murders clustered together that are completely unrelated to one another. And I think some of that is just the random chance of, you know, not to make it about cards again, but just shuffling the deck of any given day of the various things that are happening. Mm-hmm. Suddenly all I can think about is that Susie and the Banshee song, 92 Degrees, where the assertion is that at 92 degrees, people become more violent because it's hot enough to be uncomfortable, but not so hot that you can't move. Yeah. I think those happen, right?
The pain, what do you think that looking forward, looking at the landscape, what do you think we kind of need?
We're fucked.
What do you think when you look at both the spooky side of things and the true crime side of things, what do you think that we need more of and less of?
I think we need I think that the fascination people have with true crime is going to, over the next X amount of years, people are going to look in the mirror and I guess probably challenge themselves on why they love this shit so much. And, you know, good and bad. And I think that might create more of a reality check with the kinds of content that's being produced and what we're comfortable listening to. I think in terms of the paranormal, unexplained stuff, I think that in some ways, even stuff like TikTok and whatever else, you know, there's so much content out there that people are putting out stories in a way where you can see them faster and quicker. But that also comes with people just making shit up because they want to have a popular YouTube account or TikTok account, right? So I think that's going to be a little bit of that, but I think eventually we'll get to a point where, you know, the entire next generation of people is kind of immune to the stigma of the idea that there's more shit out there that we don't understand. And I think it's really kind of like almost the boomer generation that's kind of like held on to like, no, we can't, this is how things were, and it's like, no, like there's still so much shit we don't know. Yeah. Doesn't mean you gotta be all crazy crackpot conspiracy about it. That's, no one likes that anyways. But like, you can keep an open mind and, you know, look forward and, I don't know, use your own rational thinking. Sometimes, I mean, some things that I've seen, I have not been able to rationally explain. Not a whole shit ton, but enough for me to say, okay, like, I don't know, you got me there. And I know you didn't fake this. So now what? And it's, you know, and it's also one of many if you look globally. So I think we're just, hopefully we learn a lot more and we just becomes less stigmatized. And we can just figure out how to learn and move on, and we'll evolve as people through that.
Yeah, I think that I agree. I think the rise of more of the secular spooky that's not tied to specific religious belief is going to be the pathway forward. So as sort of the old guard that has these beliefs that are so tied to, I don't know, I was raised Catholic, like tied to the church, things like that, that'll go away, and then the spooky nerds will kind of seize the day because it's not tied to any specific spiritual belief. But Holly, what is your thought about, crime, history, spookiness, and just podcasts in general, what do we need more and less of?
I think we need more critical thinking, that's it.
Right?
Yes.
Like, that's the thing, I love to go yes, and so I'm going to share it. Like, think about it. maybe do a
no,
quick
post fact check. Anyways,
right?
Do
just
it.
Post it over and over.
Kidding,
all we need is, yeah, I mean, again, everything I keep yelling about, like, everything has nuance and context that shifts what it is. Like, any given fact can be singled out and made to appear in a way that isn't really what it was, just based on removing all of the context. And so, as long as people are doing more critical thinking and they're really looking at the surrounding elements of any given story and putting it in context and not just accepting things at face value as true or not, that's really all we need. More media literacy, more critical thinking.
Oh gosh, and I know we're out of time, but I have to follow up with that. Like, you know, how do we get more critical thinking when there's the dopamine hit of posting something on Facebook and on social media, and that immediate reaction, and also the memeability of things, to put out a quote or a fact about a historical figure, and it just it gets spread, like, because it feels good.
The dopamine hit of real knowledge is 100 times better than the dopamine hit of I thought that was true, right?
But if you try that fiction, it's really good. I'm kidding. I agree with you.
Yes.
I wish more.
Well, that's the thing. We just need to. It's like you can give somebody McDonald's every day and they'll think it's delicious. And don't get me wrong, I love a McDonald's meal once in a while. But then you give them like a Michelin star meal and they go, "Oh shit, that's amazing." We just need to give them Michelin star meals of information once in a while.
Or is it not McDonald's enough for you? It might not be McDonald's enough for you too.
We can cut it up into small pieces.
Okay.
Fine.
True. Yeah.
Put a big red emblem on it.
Yeah. I really wish McDonald's was a sponsor of this right now. But
where are we?
That said, we're wrapping this up, but just plug your stuff. How can people support your work?
Okay. The internet. Just Payne Lindsay is all my social media handles. Tenderfoot TV is the company that I have with all the podcasts that I make. And yeah.
Okay.
Missed in History is Stuck in History Class is Missed in History everywhere on social media. Criminalia, we just do hashtag Criminalia. We don't have specific accounts. Other than that, you know, I'm on Twitter and Instagram. It's all about my cats and food. So if you want to listen to me talk about Star Wars ad nauseum, I do that on Full of Sith every week. So many options.
Yes, you do. There's a lot of options.
I love the cats part of that. That sounds fun.
The cats part. There's a lot of it. Cats, craftiness, and Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for coming out. Thank you to DragonCon for having us here. And
thank you for hosting.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to have you guys here. And so this is Talking Strange. Thanks for joining. You know, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff. Share with you, spooky nerds. And until next time, as I always say, be kind, stay spooky, and keep it weird. There you go.
Talking Strange is a part of the Den of Geek Network, available wherever you listen to other podcasts. If you like what we're doing, share Talking Strange with your friends and fellow spooky nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and leave a nice review. If you have a strange or paranormal story you would like to share with us, please email talkingstrange@denofgeek.com for a chance to have it read on a future episode. For video episodes of Talking Strange, check out twitch.tv/denofgeektv and youtube.com/denofgeekus. And please follow @talkstrangepod on Twitter and @AaronSagers on Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon for more paranormal pop culture content.